I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Bill.
Hi, everyone. My name is Bill, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. And in August, I celebrated 30 years of abstinence. And for me, abstinence means that I stay away from my binge foods altogether. I try, over the years, I've tried to make as much of an alcoholic-type abstinence as possible, that I don't eat my binge foods. I also have a food plan. I try to eat three healthy meals a day and try to eat nothing in between, although I will allow myself a snack if it's absolutely necessary. And three well-balanced meals a day, and most of the time I succeed at that. So, but if I if I don't eat exactly on my plan, I haven't broken my abstinence. But if I do eat my binge foods, I have. So I have 30 years of not eating my binge foods. And what I'd like to do is tell you just a little bit about how I got in the program, and then I would really like to spend most of my time talking about the steps, and I'll tell you why in just a minute. I walked in the door in 1977 after having been physically ill. I had contracted dizzy spells that hadn't been explained, and I've spent about a year going to doctors trying to figure out what that was about. The dizzy spells were bad enough that I couldn't drive oftentimes with them. I would get out on the road, I'd get dizzy, and I'd have to pull off to the side and get out of the car and walk around until it passed. The original doctor diagnosed an inner ear problem and put me on some drugs, and the drugs helped for a while, but they didn't continue to help. Finally, after a number of visits back and forth, I was sent to an ear, nose, and throat specialist who told me, no, you don't have any problems with dizziness via any kind of ear problem. But he took a history, and he said, well, you know, it might be diabetes. And so he sent me back to get a glucose tolerance test. And the test results came back, and the internist said, well, you're not diabetic, but you could be. And you don't tolerate glucose well. You don't tolerate sugar well. So what you need to do is you need to start a sugar-free diet. And he gave me a drug company diet plan. And he said, and he listened to me, and he said, you know, you've got a lot of stress in your life, too. And you need to get yourself out from under the stress. So he also gave me a prescription for Valium. This was 1977, folks. This is what they were giving at that time. I was a good person. I started following what he had said, and I started taking the Valium. But I knew I needed something more. I knew that I'd lost weight before. I'd had a up and down kind of childhood, and I knew that I needed some support somehow. So I was living in a small town in Ohio, and I happened to look in the paper, and there was a little story that said there was a group of Overeaters Anonymous that was going to form. I had no idea what Overeaters Anonymous was, other than the fact that I had read Dear Abby, who occasionally talked about OA as being something that was similar to AA and that also worked. I was really embarrassed about being overweight and being in a position where potentially I could become ill for the rest of my life. And so I really didn't want anybody to know that I was seeking help. So I called the number that was listed, which was kind of a brave step for me, and found out that that I was the person who was starting the meeting was somebody I knew. So there went my anonymity right at the beginning. But I didn't get to go to the very first meeting they held, but I believe I went to the second meeting. And this woman had been an alcoholism counselor. She knew that AA worked. And she knew she had a food problem. And so she'd been going to AA meetings to try to work on her food problem, and that wasn't completely working for her. So she wrote to OA World Service and got a meeting starter pack and called a meeting and started it together. The week I went, the very first week of August in 1977, she had asked one of her AA friends to come and speak. And they gave him as much time as he wanted, which I've never seen happen before or since. And he spoke for about an hour and a half. And he told his whole story. But what he did was he went through the steps, one by one. And that clicked for me. Because, as I said, I had gained and lost weight in the past. I'd done all the things you've heard people talk about, so I won't review them. And I knew there had to be something else, and the steps seemed to be that something else. And so I listened very carefully to what he said. Even though I did not identify with him at all, he had been homeless. He had been on the streets of one of the big cities in the area. He had been in really terrible shape, and I had never had any of that kind of experience. You know, I grew up in a middle to upper middle class household, and was never really wanted for anything, and yet he said he'd been sober for quite a while, and that the steps were what worked in terms of staying sober. So I said, okay, this is what it's got to be. I'm going to listen carefully, and I'm going to work these steps. So I'm glad there's some newcomers here tonight, and thank you for being here. You really are the most important person in the room, and I'm glad to be able to talk to you. This is my second time talking at this meeting, by the way, and for anybody who might be listening to it afterward, I told my story more conventionally the last time, and if you look in the archive under Bill E., you'll find me, and you can listen to the conventional version of the story after the meeting. Let me talk about the steps that I'm going to work my own story in as I go. So let's start with the first three steps. I'm going to kind of break them up into groups. We have to be powerless in order to get in the door. I certainly was powerless. I realized that the dizzy spells had actually abated because I stopped eating sugar. The sugar consumption really was related to the dizzy spells, as it turned out. I occasionally eaten some sugar by accident, and the dizzy spells have come back. So, I know that I can't do this. I can't do sugar. It is toxic for me. I'm told by medical people that you really can't have an allergy to sugar, but that's what I tell people, is that I have an allergy to sugar. Some doctors will always get after me. Oh, you don't have an allergy to sugar. You can't have an allergy to sugar, but it affects me. And I've developed some other allergies too. I have an allergy to a minor allergy to wheat, but enough that it bothers me. So I don't eat wheat either. And I also don't eat peanut butter, which is something that came down the line later that I was using. It turned out I was using it. And so, okay, I had to stop eating that too. But those are the major things that I don't eat. Sugar and wheat's a lot. It really is. It's really, people say, how do you ever eat? Well, it's pretty easy. It's not that bad. You can eat all kinds of things and still not eat sugar. You've just got to be careful about how you do it. So I was powerless. Obviously, I had this thing that I couldn't control. But the first step also says that our lives had become unmanageable. And that was the hard one for me. I didn't want to believe that. I wanted to believe that I could lose some weight and that my life would become fine again and that I could basically go back to doing what I was doing. And I was really ignoring the fact that the doctor said, you're under a terrible amount of stress. You need this Valium. And he said that for a reason. He did not say that just you need to lose some weight or you need to stop eating sugar. He said, you need something else here to help you. And he gave me that something else. And I was very aware that I was taking it. It was doing some good, but it was also doing some not good, and it had some side effects. So, but still, I was stubborn. And I grew up that way. I grew up being told I had to be self-sufficient. I had to take care of myself. This becomes important later on. So I will just plant that seed and let them come back to it. So I've had trouble admitting that I was powerless. I had trouble admitting that my life had become unmanageable. Okay, so I just needed some kind of power to help me get through. So the second step says that we came to believe that there was a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. That would seem to be pretty easy. The group, even though it was a group of newcomers, got pretty close pretty quickly, and we were definitely helping each other, and that's what I was looking for. In terms of some kind of spiritual dimension to the program, though, I blew that off, basically, for about the first year. I had said, well, you know, I was religious back when I was in school, and forget the fact I hadn't been to church in 15 years, and I said, I believe in God, so okay, I've done that, you know, I've done that part. I've got a group, and I've got some kind of vague belief in God, and that's okay. And then the third step was that I had to turn my will and my life over to this God. Well, this sounded pretty much like evangelical Christianity to me, which I was sort of like, no. But you know, I had been to a church camp when I was in high school, and you know, they had an altar call, and I'd gone down and I'd said, yes, I commit my life to Jesus, and so I figured I'd done that. You know, I figured I'd done step three. Even though that was a really long time ago. And it took me a year before I figured out I was wrong. And the reason I ended up figuring out I was wrong was I kept trying to work the fourth step, but nothing would happen. You know, I'd get started on it, I'd write a little bit, and then nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. Finally, it took moving away from this small town and moving to a much larger city where OA was well established. And I went to a regional convention that was being held just soon after I got there. And I went to a panel called It's My Program. And there were three panelists on the program, and they were talking about how they worked their program. And I was looking for some clues about how to write a fourth step, because it hadn't been working. So I went in and I was listening to one panelist in particular who I identified with, who kept saying, you know, I turned this over, and I turned that over, and I had this other problem, but I turned it over, and everything was better. And, you know, by this time I'd been in the program more than a year, I'd lost a bunch of weight, and I went up to this woman afterward, looking like I had everything together, and said to her, you know, I loved what you had to say, but I there's one phrase you kept using over and over again I didn't understand, and that was turn it over. And, I mean, we were a group of newcomers. We didn't know the terminology. And she looked at me kind of as if she was amazed, and she said, oh, well, turn it over refers to step three, turning our will and our life over, and I do that on a continual basis. Interestingly enough, this woman and I became very connected. I started going to the meeting that she was a regular at, and I really didn't feel comfortable asking her to be my sponsor, but she was somebody who was really important in my life. And it got me thinking, you know, oh, well, if I'm not turning things over, if I'm really relying on this experience I had back in high school to say that I've worked step three, maybe I haven't really worked step three. And so then I went back and said, oh, well, wait a second, maybe I haven't worked step two either. And then I went back and said, oh, well, maybe I actually haven't worked the second half of step one. And you know, my higher power had a way of doing that. I am powerless over my car. My car makes my life unmanageable. I have to turn it over to a power greater than myself and then trust that power because I can't do my car by myself. I can't deal with, if it has problems, I can't deal with it. So I took my car in for service. This was in Minnesota. And it was the day of the first snow. And I got the car in. And I worked it all out about how I would do this. I picked out a dealer that I thought okay, let me take the car to the dealer. And I got myself to work on the bus, and the dealer kept calling me all day and saying, well, this needs to be fixed, and this needs to be fixed. And I just take it in for normal service and tune-up. And a couple, the first few times I said okay. And then after that I said, how much is this? And he gave me a figure that was way beyond my expectations for the work. And I said, don't do anything more. Just put the car back together again, and I will come and get it. So I went and picked it up. There was one windshield wiper that was broken, that wasn't broken when I went in. The car was not running well, and I limped home with one windshield wiper, the driver's side windshield wiper, in the snow, and I felt awful, just awful. And the next day, I went to a meeting. And the next day was a Saturday. I went to a meeting, and I pitched about it at the meeting. And three or four people who I only vaguely knew came up to me after the meeting, and they said, you are in no shape to do anything today. You're really in a lot of danger, we think. You know, come with us. We will take care of you. And they did. I spent the rest of the day with them. And I heard some really weird things, to be honest. And I never spent time with these people again. But you know, just that experience of having been supported and having been with people who were a power greater than myself, who helped me get through a situation and realize that, yeah, I could take my car to somebody else. And I did, and I could get it fixed, and I did, and everything was going to be okay. And it was really like having a third step experience to have been supported like that. So I realized, first of all, my life was unmanageable. Secondly, there was a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. Third, when I was willing to let that power greater than myself, then it happened. And the next day was a Sunday. I sat down with this four-step guide that I had picked up at the regional convention, and I started writing my four-step, and I didn't stop until I was finished. But of course I said at the end of it, oh, of course you're not finished, you got to put it away and come back to it. And I was right, I wasn't finished, but I put it away and didn't do anything more on it until it got too painful about 3 months later. And then I made an appointment to give it away, give it as a fifth step. Let me talk a little bit about the fourth and the fifth steps. The big book says that there are three things to write about in the fourth step. First of all, we write about our resentments. Secondly, we write about our fears. And third, we write about our sex conduct. Sex behavior. These are interesting things. Resentments and fears are feelings. And they in themselves are not character defects. I mean, this is a moral inventory, but resentments and fears are just feelings. Now, why should we write about them then? Because what they do is they mask our character defects. They come up as a result of our character defects. So if we write down when we were resentful, and if we write down what we feared and what we did, then, and we start to see patterns in that, and we inevitably will, then that's going to reveal the character defects. Simple, right? It is. It took me 12 years to get there. That first inventory, I wrote no resentments whatsoever. I didn't think I had any. And the priest who heard my fifth step asked me about the fact that I had left my resentment page blank. And I said, well, you know, I was a good kid growing up. I was the best little boy in the world. I don't think I have any resentments. And he said, don't you resent your parents just a little bit? And I started to cry. And I realized at that point that I wasn't done with my inventory. You know, that I had done what I could do. And that was sufficient for that time. And once I worked the fifth step, I threw away the Valium. And I never went back to it. and it wasn't necessary anymore. And my life changed dramatically. I was wanting to do a job change. I resigned the position I had without having another job. Fortunately, I had several months left, you know, on the position to look to, you know, the date was far enough away that I could look for a job. And I ended up out in California. I ended up in the Valley, where I stayed for 14 years and you know, was a very active member of the OA Fellowship there in the Valley. So, but it really didn't take, it really took me until I had 12 years in before I actually wrote an inventory. I wrote three or four inventories. And it really took me until I was 12 years in until I wrote an inventory where I worked on resentments and fears. And part of that was bringing up sex conduct. Sex conduct is also not a character defect. Our sexuality is God-given. We are who we are sexually. Our sexual behavior is also God-given. We are made to enjoy our sexual behavior, I believe, and we're made to help others to enjoy their sexual behavior as well. But what we tend to do is we tend to make our sexual behavior secret. We tend to make it somewhat dirty. We tend also to lie and to be dishonest in terms of gratifying those needs. And Bill W. knew that. He had a problem with it himself. And he specifically wrote about that in the big book, that sexual conduct, because it was so hidden, was something that needed to be written about. And I needed to write about it, because I was hiding that I was gay from myself. And it took being in this program quite a while before I even started to admit to myself that I might be. And it took even longer before I was willing to admit that, yes, I am. So I came out in this program, and this program really helped me in that regard. And I treated it in some ways as a character defect. You know, and in looking back on it, that was wrong. The character defect was lying to myself and being in denial about myself. It was not the sex conduct. But the sex conduct helps to bring that up if we write about it. So that's why the big book says to write about those particular three things. By the way, I couldn't figure out what a resentment was. And so what I ended up doing was to say, I will call a resentment anything that's in my past that I still have feeling about. And that worked. You know? I wrote page upon page of things. And you know, I still have trouble realizing when I'm being resentful. It's easier now. You know, after 30 years and working on it, it's a lot easier. I'm picking up more quickly when I am resentful. But I still have that denial mechanism that is very strong in many compulsive overeaters. And I still have this I gotta be self-sufficient mechanism, that strong message that I got in childhood that keeps me from wanting to admit that anything is wrong. And so I can't resent people because I wouldn't be as perfect a person as I was raised to be. I had to let some of that go. I let a lot of that go over time. But it really took over time in order to do that. And so just saying, as long as I have feeling about it, I'll call it a resentment and we'll be done with it. You know, and it's not bad. It's not an evil thing. I thought being resentful was evil. But it's not. It's something that's natural. It happens. And so when I think that, then I'm better at it. And when I think, you know, just as I think, you know, I have this condition, I can't eat sugar. I get sick when I eat sugar. It's not my fault. You know, and I got to work on it on a daily basis in order to keep myself going. And you know, that keeps me going. It makes it easy on a daily basis not to eat sugar. Because I know I'll get sick if I eat it. And I will get physically ill. So steps 6 and 7 are the last two of the second part. And I've sponsored people. The Big Book says step six is really should be done at the end of doing step five. You've identified the character defects, and you decide you're ready, and then you move into step seven, and you do it immediately. Yeah, I've never had anybody that I've sponsored who's ever done it that way.
Yeah.
And I certainly didn't do it that way. I had to sit down and think about, in step six, okay, I've got these character defects. In the last inventory I did, I had a list of 20, 25 character defects that I'd come up with out of all that writing about those feelings and things. And I said to myself, well, who would I be if I didn't have these character defects? I mean, some of them are really essential to who I am. Who would I be? Would I be somebody I don't like? Do I really want to have God remove these things and possibly transform me into a person that I don't want to be? I'm scared. And it took me a while. I finally said, I've trusted God to this point. God has done some wonderful things in my life. God got me this job in California. I certainly did not get it. They called me up. I sent in my materials, and they called me up and offered it to me on the phone without even asking me to come out and interview. And that's just in my field that you don't do that, But they did. And it took me completely by surprise. And it was higher power working in my life, not me. Completely in that regard. But I did have to get through that fear. And when I gave away the character defects, what I learned was, and there was always something that I learned from step seven in particular. There's always been some kind of miracle that's happened with step seven. It's a small miracle, but some kind of miracle that's happened. What I've learned in terms of giving away my character defects and asking them to be removed is once I do, then most of the time they are removed. Occasionally, there's one that isn't, and it's because I need to keep working on it. It's because maybe my inventory wasn't complete, and I needed to keep working on it. But what happens with the character defects is they represent a pattern of behavior. Remember, we went back, and that's how we came up with them in the first place. They came from fears, or they came from resentments, or they came from a pattern of sexual conduct, And what happens was that my disease gets me to a place that I feel like I have to do those things if I get into that situation. That this is the way I have to handle it in the situation. I become compulsive about exhibiting those patterns of behavior. And what happens once seventh step has been taken place is I may enact that pattern of behavior again, but I don't have to do it anymore. The compulsion to enact that behavior lifts. And I find that I have other choices when I get into those situations. And so the changes that happen very slowly, and they happen very... they happen so subtly that oftentimes they're not really noticed. So it wasn't like I had to become a completely new person. But on the other hand, people said to me, you're a lot different. You've changed a lot. You're doing things a lot differently than you used to. So that was interesting to me, that other people noticed it and I didn't. Now, let me tell you about one of the miracles that happened. Remember I told you that I treated my sexuality as if it were a character defect. And I had been, I'd been hiding in my sexuality, and basically the way I'd been acting on it was to use pornography. And I had gotten to the point where I was feeling pretty bad about this use of pornography. It felt compulsive to me. It felt like it wasn't something that was just normal sexuality. It was something I was keeping a secret. And And I wrote it down in an inventory, and I gave it away. I did a 6 and 7 step on it, and I said, my compulsive masturbation is a character defect. It's something that's part of me that I want to let go of. And I did let go of it for, probably a month. And then started coming back again. And I thought, maybe I didn't do this right. So, and I'm going to take off my coat at this point because it's gotten really warm. I took off my clothes. and I sat down in the middle of my bedroom. And I prayed to God, and I said, God, I am naked before you. I really need for this to be taken away. It is really hurting me. Please help me. Please take this up from me. And a couple things happened. Within about 2 weeks, I received a phone call from the only woman that I'd ever dated seriously. And she said to me, I'm going to apply for a teaching job. Would you give me a letter of recommendation? And I said, sure. And thought, why did she call me? Because I've never seen her teach. How can I really give her a letter of recommendation when I've never seen her teach? I can say she's a great person, and I did. But then once I thought about it, I realized, I've been holding on to this woman. I've been kind of clinging to this relationship because I've been so self-sufficient, I haven't had much in the way of relationships in my life. And I've been denying my sexuality, and I've been using the pornography, and I think this woman really called me to let me know that it's over, that I can really let go of her, and that the way I can do it is to write this letter of recommendation and just sort of be done with it. And that was good. And then I went to a meeting about a week later, and the speaker was talking about his pornography use. And I went up to him afterward, and I said, I'm really glad you talked about this because I was thinking about going out and getting some, and I don't feel like I have to after I heard you. And he looked at me, and he said, have you ever heard of, and then he named another 12-step program. And I said, only sort of. And he said, you might benefit from coming to a meeting. And that's how I ended up in another 12-step program, working on the sexuality issues. Turns out that I am a compulsive overeater and a sexual anorexic. And I've learned from listening to people in the rooms that those two things go together rather frequently. That part of my compulsive eating is to deal with the fact that I don't feel comfortable with sex. That I didn't feel comfortable with my own sexuality. And it took a while. It took going to lots and lots of meetings in that other program, and I would be going to a meeting every day and sometimes more than one, and having to share, and just, really, this was 12 years into the program, and I was at this point of feeling like a beginner again. And it's worked pretty well. I'm still sexually anorexic. You cannot abstain from sexual anorexia. It's impossible to do that. What would you do to abstain from sexual anorexia? So what I do is I work on the pornography addiction, and I try to put healthy sexuality into my life on a daily basis. And, I'm very grateful that today is my 18th birthday in that program. I just celebrated this morning. And it's been a great help for me. Let me move on to 8 and 9. With 8, making a list of all the persons I had harmed, I wanted to make a list of all the persons I'd come in contact with because I felt that I had harmed them just by being who I was. Let me see if I can open this a little bit. Okay. And what I've learned over the years is that in order for them, they can be on my list. I can make a list of all the people I feel uncomfortable about or however you want to do it. But in order to proceed to the 9th step, I have to be able to write down something specific that I've done to harm them. And I have to be willing to to decide what can I do that would make specific amends for the harm that I've done. And sometimes, you know, that's hard. I work with sponsees. They make this list. A lot of people, if they're working from the form that who did I resent, you know, the one that's taken from the big book, you know, a lot of those people on that list are typically people that belong on the, you know, belong on the 8-step list. But oftentimes they can't necessarily think of specific harm that they've done to them. And so we let it go. You know, I had the resentment. Maybe it affected our relationship a little bit, but I don't know if that really did specific harm. So if there's been specific harm, then we figure out what to do, and in the 9th step, we make the amends for the specific harm. It's interesting that you know, I had no resentments, and so therefore I had very few people to make amends to. And that turned out to be all right. You know, I've turned out that living amends has been much better for me than making specific amends. I didn't steal from people. I stole food from my parents. I gave them a gift. I gave them a nice gift and made somewhat non-specific amends to them, which they accepted. Then I came out to my mother later, and that was a whole other thing. thank you. So I'm gonna skip over 8 and 9, and I'm gonna get to 10, 11, and 12. 10, 11, and 12 are the living amends. Not the living amends. 10, 11, and 12 are living the program in everyday life. And essentially to me, 10 says, go back and work steps 4 through 9 as needed. Work them on a daily basis, if at all possible. You know, go back and review your day and talk about, you know, look at what went wrong. Try to make things right as quickly as possible. That's what's really worked for me, is to do an ongoing 10-step and to try to make things right as quickly as possible and to let go of resentments and feelings that I have about the particular day. Step 11 to me says work step 3 over and over again, except work it in a more sophisticated way. Try to come up with what God means for you, and try to discern God's will for your life. Boy, that's one bit of a big problem. You know, it's like, God's always helped me. God's kept me going on a career. You know, God's always gotten me my job, believe it or not. Or God didn't get me the job when I really wasn't supposed to have it. And there was one job that I really wanted that God didn't get me, and you know, it's okay. That's what was supposed to happen. I've always been led in that regard. In other areas, I've had more problems discerning what is the higher power. I've had a lot of problem with dealing with what is God. I thought God was my father. I had to let that one go. That was for sure. I now think that God is spirit. God is out there. God is willing to do whatever I need. Not always willing to do whatever I want, but willing to do whatever I need. And I have to be in a place where I have to ask. So that gets us to 12. And 12 essentially says work step 1 and help other people work step 1. So I'm back to my life being unmanageable, that I didn't want that to happen. You know, and it means that I have to admit that my life is still unmanageable on a daily basis. It's a lot more manageable than it was, but it is still unmanageable. I still have to come back to, I have come back to meetings. I have a sponsor who I call 5 days a week. I have to work with other people. I have to give back as much as I can. I have to help other people to work step 1 and understand the steps of this program. And I hope that's what I've done tonight. So thank you for letting me share. We have some time for questions, so I'll be happy to take questions. Yes, sir.
My name is Mark. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Mark.
You mentioned fear and resentments obscure the defects. And I'm noticing some resistance in me in terms of my being able to elaborate that in my own head. So could you elaborate that?
Yeah, I wasn't a very resentful person, but I was a very fearful person. I acted on fear that I wasn't good enough. I acted, and that what that did for me was to drive my ego. So sometimes go around and act like I was too good for you. I pushed people away because I was afraid of them. I pushed people away when I lost weight. I pushed people away. People got interested in me sexually, and it was like, oh no, I can't deal with this. It was, you know, my sexual anorexia kicked in. So my anorexia is fear of being judged. And I had plenty of reason for that. I was judged a lot as a kid. I was judged by my father and found to be wanting on many occasions. I, you know, ended up carrying around a resentment for that that I didn't realize that I had. But, you know, I did carry around a resentment for that. I was judged by the other kids in school because I was a sissy boy, and they could pick on me, and they did. So I was in fear. I lived in fear of being attacked as a kid, and I was attacked from time to time. I lived in fear of being humiliated. What's that hiding? Well, for me, it was hiding a pattern of behavior that I did to try to avoid having to be afraid. A pattern of behavior where I withdrew. It's different for everybody. Fears are not the character defects. I fight with the sponsee about this all the time. He wants to keep calling his fear a character defect, and I say no. Fears are feelings. Fears are feelings that I have, as are resentments. But if I'm feeling fear in a pattern of situations, if I can identify what the pattern is, that will reveal the character defect. That will reveal what I'm doing. What I'm feeling is different than what I'm doing. But what I'm feeling may be legitimate in terms of I could be in a dark alley and I could be fearful. And what I'm doing is walking down the dark alley. And maybe I need not to be walking down the dark alley, you know. I mean, if I do that on a habitual basis and I'm fearful, there's a lesson in that, you know, that I've got to do. So that's what the inventory is about, is we start with what we can access. We can access the fears. We can access the resentments. And then we write them down and don't worry about the patterns. And then we go back and look at it and use a sponsor or someone else that can help to look for those patterns. And that's what reveals the character defects. But it's a process. And one has to trust enough that for the process to work. You know, I wasn't ready to write those inventories the first year. I thought I was, but I wasn't really ready to face what I needed to face. And it actually took me a long time to be ready to face what I needed to face. But what I found is that...
Due to technical difficulties, the last 20 seconds of Bill's talk was cut off.